Cool. So we are here with Malik Rassamny, one of the directors of Native and the Refugee, a film about the commonalities of Native American life on reservations and Palestinian life on refugee camps. And he's been on the show a couple times.
Yeah.
The last time he was, it was audio from a panel at Woodbine right after the fall of Damascus. So with Trump's recent Middle East trip, I thought it would be a good opportunity to check in on what is going on in Syria and the rest of the Middle East. And you had an interesting take at the time. I don't know if you said it on the panel, but you told me that Al-Jilani, as he was known then, was a sign of a kind of a new order in the Middle East of technocratic Islamism, is I think the term that you use, and his popularity signaled a shift in that direction. And just this last week, we saw Trump meeting with him and praising him under his new name.
Yeah, strong past.
Yeah,
strong past. Handsome man, too.
His handsome guy, is, young guy, strong past.
Al-Shara, right? What's his
yeah,
name?
Ahmed Al-Shara.
Ahmed Al-Shara. This is the president of Syria. Not to be confused with Al-Jilani.
Right.
Different guy. Totally different guy. The strong past thing is fascinating because I think it shows our president's view of what it takes in the region, right? Like former head chopper with Al-Qaeda. Strong past. I guess he's the right man for the job in Trump's mind. What do you think, Malik?
I mean, that's a common trope of, you know, the idea that the Middle East can only be governed by strong men. And that was the mentality back in the 80s when Donald Rumsfeld and was selling weapons to Saddam Hussein's regime at the time. It's kind of another strong man. I don't know if it's exactly quasi-Islamism, but yeah, it's more of a... I think now that the so-called axis of resistance has been, or the Iranian, kind of Iranian order, if you will, or Shia order, has kind of fallen back. What's interesting, actually, is that Israel is largely responsible for kind of pushing back against the axis of the Iranian order in, if you want to call it that, in Lebanon and Syria, which has kind of liberated, if you will, I mean, or allowed space for those countries and Saudi Arabia, allowed space for the Arab world, really, to have a better relationship with America by removing kind of Iran from the picture. But it's funny that Israel itself is not going to be part of this party that it created because it's actually too nuts. So even though it's actually a perfect opportunity in a way for Israel to conclude a peace deal on their terms with a bunch of Arab governments who are happy to have a peace deal with Israel, they're so maximalist in their objectives, like a gambler who doesn't know like when it's time to go home. A friend of mine had that analogy, Matt, when we were discussing it, that they can't even, if they can't even be part of the gains that in a way they have created by pushing back against Hezbollah and Iran, which both allowed for a new order, a new government to take shape in Lebanon and precipitated the fall of the Assad regime, weakened the Assad regime, which allowed Ahmed al-Shara's forces, Ha'atari Hashem, to kind of have that quick sweep that happened in December where the regime kind of fell away like a house of cards. Yeah.
It's interesting. So like the Trump 1.0 was about the Abraham Accords, right? Which was about normalization of the Sunni Arab regimes, the Gulf Arab regimes, or was it only Saudi Arabia?
Well, the crown was Saudi Arabia. I mean, these were all governments that were already basically de facto wanted to make peace with Israel. It wasn't like, so he was picking at what's like basically low hanging fruit. Okay. It's not historic like Camp David in 1977, where it was a big deal, actually, when Egypt recognized Israel. This was kind of him just picking up low-hanging fruit like Bahrain, the UAE. Sudan, I don't know if they wanted to make peace with Israel, but it was a very weak government still at the time, having its own internal problems. So the difficult one is Saudi Arabia. And even though MBS would probably love to conclude a peace deal with Israel because of the symbolic weight of Saudi Arabia, both in the Arab world and the Muslim world, he cannot do that absent at least some gesture towards a Palestinian state.
Or a nuke.
Which is,
sorry?
Or a nuke, right? That's, I've heard that's what he's really after.
Probably, but I think in order for public opinion still matters to some degree, even in a country that is despotic like Saudi Arabia, there's still some need for public consensus. And Saudi Arabia cannot symbolically in front of the Muslim Arab and their local population conclude a peace deal unless there's some semblance of a Palestinian state, which this Israeli government is not even willing to grant, even in words, even in theory, let alone in practice. So I don't think there'll be an official peace deal with Saudi Arabia because of that.
Your thesis here is interesting. It's fascinating. So like the psychopathy of Israel or this Israeli government, let's call it Netanyahu plus Smotrich and others.
Ben Gavir
means that they can't politically take advantage, it seems right now, of the military gains that they've made, despite the Trump administration. I suppose maybe under Biden there may have been more possibility for a deal, but Trump allowing, I guess, the siege of Gaza to continue and the absolute destruction. Ultimately, he's called for population removal, ethnic cleansing, and genocide in Gaza, leaving no space for there to be a political compromise between what's broadly called the Arab world, I guess, or Saudi Arabia and another Gulf states. A grander bargain can't be made. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. I mean, but anything could happen. On the one hand, the Arab leaders would love nothing more than to do business with America and Israel. But at the same time, it's like we had an agreement and then now Israel's changed the goals. And now their goal isn't any more nominal fake Palestinian state, which was kind of the Oslo consensus, but actually pure. Israel's always had multiple goals at the same time, doing many things at the same time, but it's where they shift their emphasis. And now they see an opportunity and they have a desire for full ethnic cleansing, and they're not willing to at least pay lip service to the idea of a state the way they once were. And yes, that makes it hard for the Arab world to just move forward, at least officially, and make peace with them.
So in DropSite's reporting on this trip, it says that before Trump landed in Saudi Arabia for this Saudi-U.S. investment forum, Netanyahu issued an ultimatum that if Hamas did not capitulate to his demands, Israel forces would implement its own, quote, final solution in Gaza, with the ultimate aim of removing the Palestinians entirely. And it seems like the West Bank will be shortly after that. In Doha on Thursday, Trump declared, "I have concepts for Gaza that I think are very good, but make it a freedom zone. Let the United States get involved and make it just a freedom zone." And he added he would be proud to have the U.S. take it. So this is slightly different than what he was saying previously, where he wanted to turn it into a Club Med on the Mediterranean. He posted that truly horrific AI-generated video of him and Elon Musk and Netanyahu at like a Cancun style resort there. But I guess, you know, that could be a freedom zone too. Yeah, I think maybe the bourgeois conception of freedom is Club Med. So it's unclear if he's maybe trying to split the difference between the Netanyahu Kushner plan and the Arab League's plan of rebuilding the Gaza Strip without displacing 2.4 million Gazans, those who are still alive, that is. It's hard to imagine there being a compromise there. But I, you know, the narrative about this trip is that Trump is looking for these deals to enrich himself and his family. I'm not sure how much of that is just the liberal narrative, or if Trump really does have some kind of agenda to reorder the Middle East. We can play a little bit of this audio of him speaking at that conference, which is pretty interesting.
Affairs know the gleaming marvels of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi were not created by the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits like those who spent trillions and trillions of dollars failing to develop Kabul, Baghdad, so many other cities. Instead, the birth of a modern Middle East has been brought by the people of the region themselves, the people that are right here, the people that have lived here all their lives, developing your own sovereign countries, pursuing your own unique visions, and charting your own destinies in your own way. It's really incredible what you've done. In the end, the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. They told you how to do it, but they had no idea how to do it themselves. Peace, prosperity, and progress ultimately came not from a radical rejection of your heritage, but rather from embracing your national traditions and embracing that same heritage that you love so dearly.
Trump always seems so bored reading off a teleprompter.
It's yeah, not his most spirited speech, although he did he did dance to God Bless the USA and hug the flag before that. And
Well, I guess he understood he needed to be on his best behavior, and he needed to say things that, you know, were written down, because he's the master of the riff. And obviously, he his people didn't feel as though he could riff his way through this one. He had to put some principles down there. And so the principle, I guess, is that nation building bad. You know, which goes all the way back. Do you guys remember the Bush versus Gore election?
Kind of.
Vaguely.
Vaguely. One of the things that Bush dinged Gore on, actually dinging, I guess, the Clinton administration on, was this idea of nation building in the Balkans. And of course, ironically, Bush ends up, you know, listening to the quote unquote neocons and becoming a nation builder in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. But these are familiar tropes that go back decades. This kind of conception that nation building by the U.S. state is ultimately wasteful, that like you need to allow civil society and nationalism to flourish in these areas, that like there are ways in which sort of like universalism that America or the West tries to impose upon regions will always fail, because I don't know, I guess there's some like conception of backwardness or something like that. And Trump is alluding to the same thing, right? He's saying that like what we've tried to do in the past has been a waste. And really, if you look at Riyadh, if you look at what's it called, The Line, if you look at NEOM, if you look at all of MBS's amazing mega projects and turning Mecca and Medina into like shopping malls, that this is actually the future of the Middle East, and that this is what we should be, you know, pushing for, fighting for right now.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's similar to the neocon idea of like we have to bring American-style democracy everywhere, but with, you know, the American dream of like entrepreneurship and like
instead of like democracy and freedom, it's bringing like Atlantic City casinos everywhere. Yeah. You know, like this 1980s Trump vision of the good life.
Turn the whole Middle East into Atlantic City. Beautiful. That's idea. It. Yeah.
And then have Bruce Springsteen. You need to like clip his wings so he doesn't write the next like really sad song about the Middle East based around Atlantic City. That's why he attacked Bruce Springsteen at the same time.
Yeah, let's not get into the Chicken Man. What do you think, Malik, of Trump's sort of pop, like a nationalist populist gesture?
He's definitely trying to create a clear division between him and the Bush administration, and between him and previous Republicans, by basically saying, I mean, the Iraq War was obviously extremely unpopular. And then there's this, there's a perception, although I would contest it, that the United States was, I mean, yes, in Libya, you know, the Libyan intervention was very unpopular. There was a perception of U.S. intervention in Syria, which is somewhat true, but I think exaggerated on the left. But still, there's this perception of heavy U.S. involvement, certainly from the Iraq War, in the Middle East. And I think there's a growing distaste for that, obviously, in the United States. And there's this idea that's both a revolt against the hegemony of the West, or the hegemony. It's both a right and left wing kind of thing of being against this liberal hegemony and emphasizing local culture, or emphasizing, but that can also mean respect for local authoritarians. Mm-hmm. It can just be, you know, right. It can be like a 1984, you know, Eurasia, East Asia, Islamistan, whatever. And everybody can have their, every strong man can have his own garden. And I think to some degree that was, we are somewhat moving in that direction. And I think that's why, you know, on the left, we talk about this anti-war as a kind of platform, but I don't think, although Israel would love to engage and love to have the United States fight its battles in the Middle East, I don't think that was ever really on the table. I think the actions of Israel are circumscribed to the West Bank, Gaza, and maybe a little bit in Lebanon and Syria, unless an opportunity presents itself where it can credibly expand further. But what that means is that those areas, certainly Gaza and the West Bank, are totally under the discretion of Israel. Basically, they become non-entities that Israel can do with them, kind of. And we're seeing the limits of what that can mean. So yeah, I mean, it's basically a new kind of thing where every zone is handled by its strong man.
Mm-hmm.
But that would mean less Israeli influence or limited Israeli influence. But in the area where Israel is strong, or in the area that falls under Israeli domination, falls under Israeli sovereignty, it means a capacity for genocide, the likes of which we haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps in the history of Israel, where there is you can have no talk of democracy or human rights for the areas that are in Israel. And what's really interesting is this kind of strange slip in Trump's speech, where it's fascinating because he talks about how would seem genuine empathy of how bad it is in Gaza, and how we have to save the people by ethnically cleansing them. So
yeah.
it's a very strange thing where he's treating it like, you know, it's what's going on, whether by force or by peace, we have to save the people of Gaza. I mean, he's framing it, and it would feel almost genuine that he's framing, we have to save the people of Gaza, but it's like the only way. I think he's trying to convince himself that the way to save the people of Gaza is the Israeli way, because he's not ready to confront Israel on this issue. And he wants to convince himself that the way to save Gaza is to basically help Israel complete its ethnic cleansing, I guess.
Yeah, the new
And then the
plan...
way he talks about how bad it is, it's like there's no food, as though it's a force of nature when
right.
it's all what Israel's doing anyway.
Yeah, I mean, not so different from how the New York Times talks about it, or
right.
at least buries the lead. And the new plan that Trump is floating is to relocate 1 million Palestinians from Gaza to Libya, which is just...
Yeah.
You know, these things have happened before. It's possible to do this, but it would be truly horrifying.
It would be an incredible... reversion back to like early 20th century, late 19th century,
yes. Precisely,
attitudes and norms, right, around civilians and around movements of population. But this is kind of what makes Trump different. This is kind of the tension within the Trump administration between Marco Rubio, who's the head of the State Department, and also I think National Security Director at the moment, since that Waltz guy got kicked up to the UN, or kicked down, depending on how you put it. The tension between Rubio, like the neocon light in the State Department, versus Witkoff, who Trump relies on heavily, who's just a real estate investor from Long Island. He sends Witkoff around the world. Witkoff, who's a deal maker like Trump, who doesn't seem to really know the history of, say, the Palestinian people or the Israeli people or the Arab people or the Ukrainian people versus the Russian people, or at least he's not particularly interested in it, just like Trump isn't particularly interested in, it seems like, the ins and outs of the 75-year war on the Palestinian people or whatever. It's just this sort of monomaniacal deal-making attempt that is able to abstract away all of that history and just look at things in a way that I think like Biden couldn't do, Bush couldn't do, Obama couldn't do, Mark Rubio couldn't do, but you can only really do if you're deeply uninterested in any of the repercussions, the histories, the great movements of politics and people of the 19th and 20th century, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and then the site. You know, Trump is uninterested in all of that stuff, which allows him to come up with truly monstrous but innovative ways to solve what seem like intractable problems.
I don't know if he came up. I mean, I think it's Israel has definitely put the idea that they want population transfer in Gaza, and then maybe he repackaged it as some sort of a real estate deal. I mean, I agree. That's how Trump thinks, but I think it it can work maybe with countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, countries that have a similar mindset, but it fails when dealing with intractable political problems that kind of can do optimism. We saw that with Ukraine and Russia. He thought he could cook up some kind of deal, but it's not going to
happen. On day one, he said he could solve the conflict. And now right. we're at day 140 or something. And even a temporary ceasefire isn't in place.
Well, he misunderstands the motivation of Russia or Ukraine or the Palestinians or Israel, because these are fundamentally political conflicts. They're not just raw deals, and they're people who believe in concepts that go above practical considerations. You know, they have nationalist ideologies, whether it's Zionism, Russian expansionism, Ukrainian nationalism, or Palestinians' desire to simply not only not be conquered, but not be forcibly booted out from their homes. I mean, these are desires that go beyond deal making. And so Trump's logic runs up against a wall. If it was all just trade deals with Saudi monarchs, I think he'd be fine. But I think when dealing with something like Zionism or something like Russia, you know, his logic runs up against a wall. And it's going to run up against a wall if he thinks he's going to be able to just, people of Gaza are just going to be leaving their homes. Yeah.
Because Palestinian liberation is the same sort of thing, that he can't really recognize this as like a political feeling, a political movement that's like deeply imbued in the Palestinian people for 100 years at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the only way it could work is his thing in Gaza. I don't think America has the stomach to engage in violence directly against the Palestinian people. I don't think the American people want it. So what he can do is just turn a blind eye and let Israel keep punishing Gaza and escalating their genocide until finally his dystopic idea that Palestinians would love nothing more than to leave Gaza becomes a reality. And I'm really afraid of that, that's what we're going to see.
But there's been some talk that maybe there's a split or a little bit of distance now between Trump and Netanyahu. Trump did not visit Israel or meet with Netanyahu on this trip. He has apparently turned down Israel's desire to take out the nuclear production in Iran and is now apparently in talks for a nuclear deal with Iran that you know, what I've heard is that it's going to be very similar to the Obama deal, which Trump ripped up during his first term. Biden failed to reinstate it, deferring to Israel on that. And now it's possible Trump is going to go behind Israel's back and cut and reinstate something like that Obama deal, which I think we're probably all hoping is the case, because Israel wants to increase its aggression on Iran, starting with that nuclear facility, and draw the United States into that conflict. But what do you make of the Trump Iran talks? We know so little about it, but
I'm not surprised. I never was one of those people on the left who was worried about a war with Iran, and I always understood that because Israel's security is a red line for the entire region, it can give the illusion that Israel dictates foreign policy throughout the region. But no, they dictate. I mean, their security is a red line, and so in that sense, it casts a shadow for sure over everything. But that's not this. But how they behave towards other countries and what they can do in Palestine is two different things. It's not only about the power of Israel; it's about the lack of power of the Palestinians. Mm. And so, while I'm not surprised when America can set limits and has been able to set limits on Israeli behavior outside of Israel, and when America has autonomy in how it acts with other countries, that has nothing to do with standing up for the Palestinians in the West Bank or in Gaza. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised that America or Trump would put Israel in its place when it comes to Iran. But that's very different from stopping them at all when it comes to Gaza, because there's no national interest. There's only humanitarian, because there's no real reason outside of human decency and justice that you would stop what Israel's doing in Gaza. And until there's a price to be paid to the U.S. for that, which doesn't seem there is, there's no incentive for the United States to confront Israel there. And the ethnic cleansing of Gaza is more important to Israel than confronting Iran. Confronting Iran is like a strategic goal of Israel, whereas ethnically cleansing of Gaza speaks to the soul of Zionism in a way. the soul of a certain interpretation of Zionism. So the ethnic cleansing of Palestine has always been far more important for the Israelis. And it's always, and there's a far less price to pay for it than there is with these larger geopolitical things.
Well, it seems like Iran, the threat Iran posed, direct threat to Israel, is largely
neutralized
by knocking Hezbollah down.
And changing the regime in Syria. Weakening it so that it changed.
Yeah. And sorry to jump around so much. I mean, this is like, there's so many moving parts. Yeah.
We could talk about this for like 17 hours and still not touch the tip of the iceberg.
And this is why we have Malik on, because he seems to understand this on the complexities of it. Another thing that I did want to ask about is Israel's operation in southern Syria. Nominally to defend the Druze population. Right. They are talking about annexing a large part of Syria or occupying it. I guess they are occupying a lot of it. Claiming that the man formerly known as al-Jilani is allowing forces to have pogroms against Druze population or aggression against Druze population. Are you familiar with the situation of what's going on?
It's funny, as before I was watching an interview with Walid Jumblat, who is the nominal head, if you will, of the Druze community in Lebanon. I mean, the Druze quickly are a religious minority. They're understood to be Arabs. I mean, they are Arabs. In Israel, there's this idea that they're a separate ethnicity similar to the Kurds, but that's not the case. There's a debate, perhaps, about whether or not they're Muslim, and we can have that discussion, but they're definitely Arabs. Ethnically, and they're part of the region.
Why do they want them to not be Arabs? Is there like a
divide and conquer? So the idea is, so what happened is when the Druze exist in today Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and Israel. In the case of Israel, they didn't flee, they didn't leave, so they stayed and became like the 48 Palestinian citizens of Israel. However, unlike the 48 Palestinians who are Christian or Muslim, they serve in the military. And they're kind of like, you know, more royalist than the king. You know, they're kind of like a bit like the anti-Castro Cubans in Florida. So they're super, now there might be some resistance, but they're kind of a vanguard of the IDF, along with Bedouins as well.
They fought in Gaza the IDF commanders was Druze or something like that.
Yeah, so they're very powerful. The military has been a way for, first of all, they serve as they're obligated to, much like the Jews, but it's also a means for advancement in Israeli society. It's a way for them to advance.
They were seen as heroically serving in this genocide in Gaza. So there's some kind of popular aspect to defending the Druze, like rewarding them for their heroism. But then what do you think Israel's really after with this incursion into Syria?
Right. So the Israelis have always seen the Druze and the Kurds also as like potential allies. So what it is that basically, you know, the whole Syria area has been under the Ottoman Empire was like a Sunni. It was the majority of people in the Levant and Syria, Lebanon are Sunni Arabs, city-dwelling or farmer Sunni Arabs. And for a long time, colonialists have always used the minorities, Christians, Alawites, Kurds, even Bedouin, as ways of kind of deconstructing that power, right? There's a minority ruling in Jordan. The king of Jordan is not from, he's from Mecca. He's from the Hejaz, you know? So he's not, the majority of Jordan is Palestinians. Syria, the army was built by French put the Alawites in the army. Lebanon was a state that was created under the leadership by the French putting in the Maronites in power in Lebanon. And then Israel is the most extreme example because not only is it a minority, but they're settlers. They're not from the region, which makes them different from the other examples. So they're not like local minorities. But anyway, I digress. I think, contrary to what the left has thought, I don't think the Assad regime ever, Israel ever desired the fall of the Assad regime, or at least that there was a debate about the issue. I don't think it was like their plan. When the revolution happened, there was, I think, a divide within Israel where half the people, where some folks in Israel thought it's better if we get rid of Assad, can get some new government, another half are saying we don't know what will happen after he leaves. He's the enemy we know. And the enemy we know is better than the enemy you don't know, because they could predict Assad's behavior. And indeed, the border between Syria and Israel was quite safe under Assad's leadership, even though he wasn't like a puppet that they could control like Jordan or Egypt. Now, what happened in the last, you know, since the war started, and as really since Assad kind of cemented his rule, or the rule of really Iran and Russia through him after the fall of Aleppo in, I think, 2016, rather, what Israel has always desired is to push Syria into the realm of Russia. What made them nervous is not Assad, it's Assad's reliance on Iran. So they would never really target the Syrian regime. This is new. They would target Iranian military installations near their border, because what made them nervous was the Iranian element of it. And their idea was always to push Israel into the realm of Putin, into the realm of Russia, who they trust far more than Iran, obviously. And they also trust Russia more than Turkey. Turkey also makes them nervous. And this new government is obviously aligned with Turkey.
And we have Israeli and Turkish forces, as I understand it, mingling in Syria, right? Coming up, they're almost, Turkey and Israel obviously geographically don't have a border, but they're almost like creating one now, like a porous border. Is that right?
I don't know if there are Turkish forces south of Damascus.
Maybe proxy forces.
Right. But depends what, because you have actual Turkish proxies, and then you have forces of the government that are aligned to Turkey that some people call proxies, but are not really proxies. So what is a Turkish proxy is a kind of a gray line. But you have actual Turkish proxies, but I think they're more in the north. And then you have other forces that are aligned to Turkey, because the government has an alliance with Turkey, but I don't know if they're Turkish proxy forces. But anyway, but there's definitely Turkey has now influence in Syria, definitely. And that makes Israel very nervous. And so Israel, they're a master at combining defense with offense. They have genuine, what they perceive of as genuine threats, but they always use them to like further expand. And this is a classic example where they feel threatened by this new government. It's unpredictable to their eyes. So they want to use the Druze to create a buffer between them and that regime, and then possibly open the door to annexing that territory as well, as they've done in 1967 and 1948, always using their defense as a way to take more land. And then they have to defend that land that they took, and they expand more. So that's kind of what they would like is a return to a great, they want Syria to really be under the control of great powers, not full on division of different countries. And I don't think they're that ambitious, but they would love it if Russia was more in control, let's say in the south, America in the northeast, and kind of isolate Turkey in the north. Keep Turkish influence kind of north of Aleppo and not in the south. But that's been, you know, this idea of building a Druze state has been along for a long time. Under the French mandate, the French had Syria divided into four sections: a state around Damascus, a state around Aleppo, an Alawite state along the coast, where the Alawites are, where there was a massacre, unfortunately, a few months ago, and a Druze state in the south. And it was the Druze under Sultan al-Atrash, who was like a Druze hero, who started a rebellion against the French, you know, pushed the French out in a way, and unified Syria. So it'd be quite a horrible and dark irony if the very same forces that pushed for the unity of Syria, which is the Druze of Sueda, now became an instrument of foreign colonialism. But, you know, Walid Jumblat, who I don't always agree with, but he made a good point. It's a war about history. It's a war of history. And we have to remember, I think now with so much change and such drastic changes in the way people, in which people live, I mean, we're losing touch with our history, even our history of the 20th century. And then into that absence of an identity, absence of knowing who you are historically, different forces can come in and rearrange things. But the Druze of Syria have always been proud. I mean, they've had, what worries the Druze, and this is understandable, is they want to make sure that the constitution is secular. Mm. And that's what they're worried about. And the constitution as it stands now allows for wiggle room for an Islamic interpretation.
Right.
Which is always a fear. I mean, I do think Ahmed al-Sharaa is pragmatic and he's a smart person, but he also has ideologues around him And he has to kind of strike a balance between the ideologues and him wanting to rule. And never mind the fact that the country is majority Sunni. Now, whether all Sunnis want an Islamist rule, I don't know. But there's varying scales of what Islamism can look like. But I think you have to push for a constitution that makes it clear that there will be no religious influence in the government. Otherwise, it opens up the door for other forces or Ahmed al-Sharr or whoever later on to have a truly Islamist government. And so that's what the Druze are pushing for. And also to have clear steps that ensure a democratic transition, which we haven't seen yet.
So al-Sharr, you think he does want to keep the country unified?
Yeah.
He's not trying to break it up.
No.
And is it clear to you how important Islamism is? He still like an unreformed al-Qaeda guy deep down, or is he really just trying to, is he honestly just trying to stabilize and unify the country after over a decade of total destruction?
He definitely wants to stabilize the country and unify it, that's for sure. Now, whether he has, I think he does, he reminds me a little bit of Nasrallah in a sense, is kind of pragmatic figure, but has an ideological background as well. I think for a certain generation of Syrians, especially of Sunni, like jihadism was the way that you fought the system. It was kind of the thing you had to pass through. But if you look, I mean, Nusra's behavior is different from ISIS, but they were always the counter-revolution within the revolution. Unlike ISIS, which was totally outside completely, because they never desired really the overthrow of the Assad regime. That's the big difference. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham was fighting with rebels to overthrow the government. ISIS was not. I think he's a pragmatic figure, but I can't tell. But he's definitely shown, which is both good and bad, is this proclivity, which is normal, is to meet with the big leaders of different areas, but not meet with other political parties. And that's kind of the classic Ottoman style, Arab dictator style way of doing things, where you meet with the big men of the different regions. So he has met with people from different religious communities and people from different regions throughout Syria, but he hasn't met with much with civil society or much with political opposition. And it's obvious that he desires foreign approval. So he's repeating a lot of the same mistakes that other Arabs have made. But at the same time, quickly, it's not just about him. The attitude of Syrians is different now that the regime has fallen. The regime following, to me, is the precondition for progress in Syria, regardless of what regime comes afterwards. Similar to the end of the occupation is the precondition for progress in Palestine. So even if tomorrow the Israeli occupation were to finish and a horrible government came into Palestine, we'd have to fight against that government. But you'd never say, oh, that's a good justification for the Syrian, for the Israeli occupation. It's more like understanding that the fall of the Syrian regime was the precondition under which the struggle for Syria's future can now be waged. It's not an endorsement in any way of Ahmed al-Sharr. And that means that the Syrians themselves, like right now, there was some kind of infighting between Druze forces and the Syrian government. There was basically a Druze person who insulted the Prophet Muhammad on YouTube. That was clearly a conspiracy somehow. I don't know if it was the Syrian government planting it as an excuse to kind of come down on the Druze, because the Druze have not given up their arms. That's the major issue. So, or if it was an Israeli thing to provoke tension to also have a justification. I've heard interpretations both ways. I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I don't think that a Druze guy out of nowhere just wanted to start shit with the government. It's either the government trying to look for a way to attack the Druze in order to discipline them, or Israel trying to create problems. But that was fixed. But what's interesting, or it's been temporarily put aside, but what's interesting is that autonomously, different factors in the aftermath of that, different sections of Syrian society, Kurds, Alawites, Christians, Sunnis from different regions, had their own autonomous meetings and then put together statements that they would then address to the government. So the mentality of Syria is different. Syrians now move around Syria more. There's more dialogue from one region to another. A lot of the activists who were in Germany and America have since returned to Syria. So the climate is different.
You're talking about just the last few months.
Yeah. My point is, I'm hopeful about Syria, not because of Ahmed al-Sharr. I'm hopeful because the climate of what Syrians can do is different. And it depends now how much pressure can they apply to him. But I think there's active, there's a possibilities for Syrians to organize both on the local level and on the political level now that didn't exist before. That's the major difference. Not so much his particular government. I think his government, I think he wants to be a soft Islamist authoritarian. I don't think he wants the same kind of harsh totalitarian system that the Assad government had, but he definitely doesn't want democracy. I think he wants to be a kind of, I think Erdogan is his model ish, something like that. A kind of technocratic, open for business, soft Islamist dictatorship. But I don't think he wants to return to the complete police state that we saw under the Assad regime. But that's not something that I want, obviously, or you know. So the hope is really in the Syrian people and in their ability to move now, not so much in any government.
Exactly on that point, what has changed since the Arab Spring, which was 14 years ago, I guess? The balance of forces, the potential for there to be liberatory movements in the area. I think that your comment that Islamism, either harsh or soft, is sort of a thing that political leaders passed through over the last 15 years is an interesting point. It was clear that the liberal forces, the progressive forces, were very weak in Syria, in Libya, in Egypt, especially, right? And that sort of Muslim Brotherhood, soft Islamism was the, let's call it the path of least resistance, or at least that which was able to animate the masses. Has much changed in the region in the last 15 years or so? When you say that freeing itself from the Assad regime is the precondition for politics in a place like Syria, how can we imagine things operating differently after 15 years or so of civil war and changes to the economy and politics and geopolitics and all that?
Each country is a bit different. In the case of Egypt, there's the military that's a dictator, not a particular family. So it's harder to imagine a complete collapse of the government in a place like Egypt than it is in Syria, where Assad could not compromise. Right? They can remove Sisi and put someone else, and the regime would be preserved in Egypt. That's impossible in Syria. And that's why the regime had to fall, because there was no, it couldn't negotiate itself. Iran kind of can, to some degree. Like, other authoritarian governments can make superficial reforms and stay in power. The Syrian government couldn't, because of its similar to Libya and Iraq in that sense, or the Gulf monarchies. But at least the Gulf monarchies have the good sense to call themselves monarchies and not pretend to be republics. But each country is different. It's hard to.
Well, let me phrase it in a different way. It occurred to me when Assad fell that this was the end of Baathism. Baathism as like a secular nationalist movement of Arabs tied to Arab nationalism, you know, this conception that you could have like a universal in the region, and that universal being a sort of ethnic, linguistic, federated nationalism that might.
That died a long time ago. I would say that died. I think that died after 1967 in reality, and died as a real thing in 1977 with the Camp David, you know, once Egypt.
And yet Saddam Hussein and what's his face, Bashar al-Assad, persisted, right? Like you had a sort of zombie
Saddam, yeah. Bashar al-Assad, it's difficult to say that, because at the end, this is a government that allied with Iran. It supported the United States, well, many countries, but it was the only Arab country to ally with Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. Yeah, I think Iraq started that war, but still, it's a weird position for an Arab, so-called Arab nationalist government to take.
I was going to say, I'm not like a partisan of Baathism, and I don't.
I know what you mean. Listen, Arab nationalism is a nice idea. I grew up.
It's a nice idea.
It's gone, but it's not gone, because it's gone as a political ideology. But there is something called the Arab world, because they speak the same language. It's not the Arab revolutions, the Arab Spring, even though it was not ideological, it's proof of some kind of Arab world. Mm-hmm. I mean, why does something happening in Tunisia resonate in Yemen? Doesn't really make sense unless there's something called an Arab world,
right?
Which Al Jazeera, you know, and media has been a big part of. So, but there is an Arab world. Whether it's going to be an Arab nation, I always thought the idea of making a nation out of the Arabs was a little bit of a tall order. I think the countries that exist are the countries that exist. I don't see they're going to change much. But there is obviously and I think I don't think ideology matters to the younger generation as much as it did. I think situations of war, neoliberalism, urbanization, and Islamism have kind of deracinated people from different ideological vectors to the extent that these ideologies were widespread. But I think there's still a sense of the Arab world, and I definitely think it's manifested most in people's, the genuine support that most Arabs, if not all, feel for Palestine. Mm. And that's still there. And that's why, and that does act as a limit on what Arab governments can do up to a point. So but I think most of all, people want to move forward. And yeah, I mean, there's a kind of neoliberal, if you will, or just kind of, people are just don't want corruption. They want economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of. But there's still a sense of their identity, but it doesn't have the same. Yeah, unfortunately, that history. I mean, I think it's important to move beyond that history and not be stuck in it, especially since that history has become a weapon for the preservation of really ossified dictatorships. Yeah, I mean, I was watching an interview with Edward Said in the early 90s, where he really takes Arafat to task for signing the Oslo Accords. Not because he's against the idea of peace with Israel, but because Arafat didn't even read the document properly. There was no specific in wording move for a Palestinian state.
But yeah, anyway, his book about the peace process makes it very clear about what a sham that whole thing was.
Yeah. And how it was basically a way of putting a stop to the Intifada, which was the first Intifada, which was an actual people's movement, similar to the Arab Spring, actually.
Yep.
But it was a movement against it because by that point, the Palestinians in West Bank were so integrated into the Israeli economy that when they revolted, it was like a working class revolution within Israel. It was like an anti-apartheid struggle within Israel. And so the move to create the Palestinian Authority was a way of kind of creating a kind of sub-state within Israel, but a sub-state that could be then ethnically cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he talks about it. He talks about how at that point he saw that the Arab regimes were kind of over. And he grew up with them, right? And that was in 93. And they lived on another 20 years until the Arab Spring. So, but there hasn't been, the aftermath has been chaotic. And it seems like Saudi Arabia is kind of the strongest, one of the stronger forces within this new order. Yeah, I think it's important to talk about. It's important. So in one sense, I mean, moving beyond the ideology is important, but it's also important to remember history and have that sense of identity. No, I can never fuck with that shit. Hey, no, I can never fuck with that. Who you know dropped the album
back again. I'm back again and snap again. If you're interested in listening to the rest of this episode, including a discussion of the PKK and the PYD and Israel's hegemonic role in the region and a bunch more, you can sign up for the Patreon. Free members can listen to this episode. So do sign up and check it out, and we'll see you on the other side. A dream like I'm David Ames. Talk all you want, we are not the same. Step in a spot that ain't know the name. So more albums my first week than Harry Styles and Katy Perry. That ain't a sign of the times. Then I don't know what is, man. This shit is scary. Cause bitch, I've been blowing up like C4 when I'm 3-4.